Welcome. I'm Angie Cuero, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. That means it's your chance to weigh in on the stories that mattered most this week and how well or how badly they've been covered. Much of the news this week was from the economic front, so let's review quickly some of those. At Knox College in Illinois, President Obama spoke on obstructionism in the Congress, his press for more manufacturing in the U.S., and the greater role he sees for the Internet in college educations. On the 21st, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act turned 3 years old. Has Wall Street been reformed, and do consumers feel any more protected? Media outlets around the country gave largely negative summaries of what it has and hasn't accomplished. We'll take our own look at that. And against a backdrop of complaints that neither the president nor the Congress has really spanked the Wall Street icons that brought the country to its knees, the Justice Department announced indictments of the hedge fund manager SAC Capital. Now, that's not as widely a recognized name on Main Street as, say, Goldman Sachs, but is still a major Wall Street player. Now, is that symbolic, or does it give a hint that consequences will finally be brought to bear? Helping us review these stories from the week are Mark Gongloff, chief financial writer at the Huffington Post. Mark, welcome to the show. Kevin Hall is with us as well, economic correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Kevin, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And of course, integral to the program are your calls at 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134. If you would like to discuss developments in Egypt this morning, I'd like to encourage you to call right away because we will only have our guest on that for a very brief time. Ahmed Shakur, an independent journalist based in Cairo, is going to join us in just a few moments for just a few moments. So if you would like to comment on that developing story, we would like you to grab a phone line right away, 415-841-4134. But let's start with our traditional open for the Friday Media Roundtable show, and that is starting things out on a positive note. We give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. Kevin, we'll start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I would recommend your listeners to look at a Sunday and Monday package of stories in the New York Times about the United States weigh-in inquiry into big bank storage of commodities. It's a theme that we've been kind of a lonely voice in the wilderness on for several years, and the New York Times is thankfully joining us in looking at this issue of big banks who are, you know, getting into the physical market for commodities, their storage of aluminum, tankers, oil storage facilities in New Jersey, et cetera. I think a lot of Americans would be quite surprised to learn the degree to which the big Wall Street banks are involved in the physical delivery of markets. And the story, the two stories don't go into tremendous detail. At least they're focusing on the issue, which is, you know, why are these banks who are in the futures markets and the commodities markets and the over-the-counter dark markets and now in the physical markets, why are they allowed to play in all these markets where they have what would we call asymmetrical information flows that gives them a tremendous advantage in the marketplace.
Thank you for that, Kevin. And I'm going to take the same question, of course, over to Mark. What did you see this week that you want to give props to?
Well, Kevin and I should get some checks from the New York Times, because I'm going to also recommend another New York Times story. I really like the one he was talking about, and I think this one is connected, but it is sort of it is a discussion of the impact of Wall Street getting its fingers into so many different pies, and that is helping to raise income inequality. I think it's a really key factor in driving inequality higher. And on Monday, the New York Times chief financial writer, David Leonhardt, had a very good story, very interesting story. The headline is "In Climbing Income Ladder, Location Matters." And this package, it was published on July 22nd, and it had a lot of really cool interactive graphics that showed very dramatically how, and it's based on a study by some economists at Harvard, and it shows dramatically how where you live really has a huge influence on your ability to get ahead in life. And one of the most dramatic illustrations, a child born to a relatively poor family in Seattle has just as much chance of earning $100,000 by the time he or she is 30 years old as a child born to a middle-class family in Atlanta. And so, again, the point is, in some cities, in some parts of the country, it is very difficult to get ahead. In other parts of the country, it is relatively easier. And there are all kinds of different factors that affect that. I think the Times story didn't focus enough on the role of policy. I mean, I think policy is important, and I think that these economists have explored that a little bit and shown that tax policy has an effect on that. But there are other things, too, like ease of access to public transportation and education and good education and stuff like that that makes a big difference in income inequality and opportunity in this country.
Being born under the sign of Microsoft is probably going to help you out if you're right there in Seattle.
That's true.
Let's do turn our attention to Egypt, where, of course, a situation is going to be developing over the course of the day. And I want to remind our listeners that this guest will only be with us for a few minutes. So if you have questions or comments on that developing situation, 415-841-4134 is the number to talk with Ahmed Shoch, who will only be with us for a short while. He's an independent journalist based in Cairo. And the situation there, of course, is since July 4th, when the military ousted the president. The conversation here in the U.S. has been about what we should call the military's move, whether it's a coup or whether it's a continuation of the 2011 uprising. The situation in Egypt, though, is getting more complicated and violent by the day, and the military has called for mass protests there. Whether that means a call for protests or actually a call for violence is the real question. And, Ahmed, it's good to have you here, and I really thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I would ask you how the situation is developing this morning. There's been conjecture that this is a call for violence, or that because the supporters of military and the supporters of the president are both massing in the street, both in action or reaction to the call from the military, there seems to be the thought that this is inevitably going to end in violence. Are we seeing signs that it's coming to that?
Well, the turnout on the street today has been enormous, on both sides, actually. And the incidents of violence so far have been fairly minimal. There have been clashes in Alexandria, Egypt's second largest city. I believe there's two reported deaths so far. And, you know, we'll see what the rest of the evening and the coming days brings. But, you know, I think Egypt is moving in a very worrying direction right now. We're essentially witnessing a showdown between two of the most undemocratic institutions in the country, the Muslim Brotherhood on one hand and the military on the other. And there doesn't seem to be any intention on either side, at least so far as their public statements suggest, to back down. Now, you know, the real question in the coming days is not how many numbers can one side or another mobilize. I mean, we know for sure that virtually every side in Egypt can mobilize large amounts of people. I mean, we've seen that repeatedly over the past 2 years. The real question is whether there's any potential for some sort of negotiated solution to come out of this this conflict, or if we're heading towards a more serious crackdown by the military and security authorities on the Islamist on the Muslim Brotherhood and their allies in the Islamist movement. Cairo judge today ordered the pre-trial detention of former President Morsi for 15 days, pending investigations into charges of conspiring with Hamas and organizing prison breaks during the 18 days that toppled Mubarak. You know, this is, to my mind, a sign of a pretty serious escalation, and I worry a great deal about what the coming days are going to bring.
Let's go right to the phones and get to as many callers as we can while we still have you, and we'll start things off with Max in Berkeley. Max, welcome to the show, and thank you for waiting.
Thank you very much for taking my call and for a good program, as usual. I read an interesting piece in the New York Times today, a Faustian bargain with the Egyptian army, and the article does a good job of describing the trajectory of the army, especially under the progressive, glorious days of Gamal Abdel Nasser. But the army today is a different animal altogether, and the gist of it is that these people cannot be trusted. And so I'd like to have you guests comment on that.
All right. Ahmed Shoch, please.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that a very wide swath of public opinion in Egypt is now fully in support of the army. And that's in part because the army has found very loyal allies in most state institutions, as well as in both the state and the private media. I mean, for the past few days, there's been a relentless media campaign to demonize the other side, the Muslim Brotherhood, and to rally support behind the army as a sort of patriotic institution. You know, for the first time, we see the Defense Minister Sisi, who spoke on Wednesday and called for the mass marches today in Cairo, you know, emerging as a sort of you know, political leader, a figure around whom a sort of cult of personality has begun to develop, which is something we haven't seen for any political figure in Egypt in the past few years. So, you know, there's no doubt that there is a massive campaign behind the army's maneuvers that's intended to rile up public opinion in support of, you know, what might be an impending and more serious crackdown.
Max, I thank you for the call. Mark and Kevin, I'm going to bring you in here in just a moment. But one thing I want to ask our guest is your impression of why, if the military is garnering the goodwill of the people, why they're choosing to spend that goodwill on a call for, even though they're calling it an authorization to fight terrorism, it's being pretty widely construed as a call for violence. It just seems like an odd thing to spend their public capital on.
Right. I mean, I can't really delve into the intentions of the defense minister. I don't know why he chose to pursue this strategy. I think many people were, in fact, taken by surprise after the speech on Wednesday. Prior to Wednesday, the army had been seen as certainly an arbiter in Egyptian politics, the most powerful institution in the country, but one that largely preferred to rule from behind the curtain, you know, with a civilian facade. Now, it's funny that during the speech on Wednesday, Defense Minister Sisi didn't mention the civilian government even once that he himself appointed. So there's no question about who's really in charge in Egypt. But I, you know, come back to the fundamental question here, which is, you know, was this move by Sisi designed to gain leverage in negotiations with the Muslim Brotherhood and to bring more pressure to bear on them to rejoin the political process, or is this the beginning of a much more serious crackdown? I'm inclined to believe it's the latter, but we'll see in the coming days which, of course, the military, you know, backed by other security and establishment institutions in the state, choose to pursue.
We have a few more moments left with Ahmed Shok, an independent journalist based in Cairo. And we're talking now to Harry, who's checking in from San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yes, good morning. I read that the Egyptian media is not covering the massive Morsi turnout. And I'm wondering what repercussions that has for society if the military is manipulating the news coverage to the extent where the opposition can't be seen, because it seems like that's they want not have people know how massive it is. At the same time, is counterproductive in the long run, I would think.
Harry, I'm glad you asked that, because the Muslim Brotherhood media outlets were shut down when the military took over. A number of the top officials are arrested and being held. So what effect has that had on the media landscape right now in coverage in Cairo and Egypt, Ahmed?
The media landscape is highly polarized right now. The majority of state and private media are firmly behind Defense Minister Sisi and the army. Many private stations have adopted against terrorism, between quotes, as their slogan, and have even been calling upon people to take to the streets today. Now, on the other side, you're correct to point out that a number of Islamist stations were immediately taken off the air after the coup of July 3rd. But there are still a handful of pro-Morsi stations out there. I mean, the most important example is Al Jazeera, which has been very active in covering the pro-Morsi side of the story over the past couple of weeks, and, you know, whose narrative is equally one-sided, but, you know, biased towards the Brotherhood and their allies. So it's a very, very divided media landscape right now, and it's having a tremendous effect on public opinion, which is becoming equally polarized. I mean, the voices of critique that we hear now in Egyptian society are few and far between. A small minority of groups and the figures have spoken in opposition to both calls for protests today. I think I could probably count them on one hand. You know, there's the April 6th movement in Egypt, a youth movement that issued a statement essentially denouncing both sides today. There's a smaller group called the Revolutionary Socialists. But, you know, the voices that are critical of both the military and the Brotherhood side, and which, you know, I think are the voices that need to be heard the most in this situation, are not getting much attention.
And with that, I want to turn this over to our other guests in case they'd like to get some final questions in about the situation in Egypt. Mark, let's start with you. Mark Kungeloff is chief financial officer at the financial writer at the Huffington Post. Mark?
Hey, yes, there was an interesting story in the Wall Street Journal today about the stabilization recently of Egypt's economy. Actually, that was last night, and how that might be helping keep things relatively cool. But I got the sense that maybe it was also just a sort of a temporary reprieve. So I'm curious about your thoughts about what role the economy is playing in this now or will in the future.
There's no doubt in my mind that many of the millions who took to the streets on June 30th against President Morsi were motivated, at least in part, by economic grievances. I mean, the weeks before Morsi's fall, inflation had become routine in Egypt. Gas queues, power outages were regular occurrences that were really affecting people's daily lives. Now, that said, the Egyptian economy today suffers from very deep structural problems. On the short run, there's a deficit and a balance of payments difficulties that need to be corrected. On the longer run, of course, there's major questions about income distribution and generating employment, especially for young people, for which no government over the past 2 years has actually articulated a coherent strategy. So, you know, these are questions that are going to require very deep reforms. I don't think there are things that the current transitional government is going to be addressing. What I expect is for Egypt to continue surviving over the next few months on cash handouts, essentially, from their wealthy neighbors, especially in the Gulf, but it remains to be seen how they're going to deal with these very, deep structural problems, and what an alternative economic policy for Egypt is going to look like. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the possibility of an IMF loan that would be tied to a reform program that, among other things, imposes some degree of austerity measures. Will the new Egyptian government choose that route? Or will they be able to, carve out a different policy altogether that doesn't rely on the IMF and those kinds of more neoliberal prescriptions? I mean, these things have yet to be worked out, and I don't think they're going to be worked out until there's a little more political stability in the country.
Kevin Hall with McClatchy Newspapers, economic correspondent. Any thoughts from you before we let Hakmi go?
Well, more or less a question and more just an observation, having spent a good bit of my career in Latin America, which went through its own lost decade in the 80s. The damage that's being done economically and the lost generation in terms of people's ability, young people's ability to find meaningful work and launch careers, et cetera, the consequences of all this won't be over in 2 or 3 years, even if things stabilize. And I guess that's from an economic standpoint, what's so troubling is the lasting tentacles from something like this. It's going to be a whole generation before things get back to normal, assuming there's a happy outcome in the short term.
Ahmed Shalk, it's one thing for us to sit here in the States and listen to you, and it's another for you to be there on the ground and with your own concerns. I wish you the best of luck, and I thank you for spending some important moments with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Your Call here on KALW. I'm Angie Cuero, and we're going to continue to review the stories of the week with your commentary coming in via the phone lines 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134. And we switch to things that are mostly economic at this point, just because that's dominated the headlines so much. We start off with the third anniversary of Dodd-Frank, and that's the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. And, of course, that was passed with a great deal of attention around the country to what they felt was major malfeasance on the part of big Wall Street bankers, big Wall Street outlets. And I have to say, Mark Gongloff and Kevin Hall, that the reviews on this third anniversary from just about every news outlet in the country and opinion outlet in the country have been pretty largely negative. It seems like nobody's real happy, nor do they think that that Dodd-Frank accomplished anywhere near what it set out to do. Mark?
Well, one problem in judging Dodd-Frank at this point is that not all of Dodd-Frank, in fact, most of Dodd-Frank, has not actually taken effect yet. Regulators are on the hook to write many, many thousands of pages of regulations and rules, and so far they've only written about a third of those, or a little bit more than a third of those. So it is still difficult to fully judge it, but sure, the results so far have been disappointing at best, but part of that is because the lobbying efforts by Wall Street have helped to slow the rulemaking process down, and so they're fighting about things like the Volcker Rule, which would prohibit banks from gambling with their own money. Stuff about derivatives regulation has been a key point of fighting for years now, and those fights are not going away anytime soon. So that's why you're seeing some more efforts on coming out now. The frustration is leading to things like the Brown-Vitter bill, Warren McCain trying to split banks up again or make them hold much more capital. And so some of these efforts, the sort of failure of Dodd-Frank to get going has sort of led to some somewhat encouraging efforts, that are sort of unrelated to Dodd-Frank. For example, the new rules that U.S. bank regulators have suggested, have proposed for making banks raise more capital and take fewer risks with the money they have. So that's somewhat encouraging, but the verdict is still to come. But so far, I'm not encouraged personally.
Kevin, any more encouraged than Mark is?
Yeah, I'm a little bit more encouraged. I think the fact that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is still alive and finally got its director, despite all the legal wrangling to the contrary. I think the Commodity Futures Trading Commission has gotten new powers, notwithstanding efforts to starve it in the appropriations process. I think a lot of the kind of the things that are less visible to the public, I think there have been a lot of good changes. I think we've got an SEC that's a lot more aggressive, enforcement-minded. You can't undo the past. And the problem with a bill like Dodd-Frank is it fights the last battle, not the next one. And so, as my colleague had suggested, the verdict is out on a lot of these bigger ticket things. But I do think it addressed a lot of things that went wrong, particularly on the mortgage side, the fact that yield spread premiums, that banks got a legal form of kickback to mortgage brokers. The mortgage broker industry is virtually eliminated under Dodd-Frank. I think a lot of good things have happened on smaller, less visible levels. But yes, the big things like too big to fail, the Volcker Rule, and how to regulate these dark derivatives markets have been more problematic. And an interesting tidbit.
Actually, I'm going to ask you to hold that tidbit till the other side of the break here, because we're just about to come up to that break. And I do want to give out a phone number for those of you calling from outside the Bay Area to contribute to our show, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We'll be right back here on Your Call.
All the stories that you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable will be posted at yourcallradio.org. We also invite you to highlight the reporting that you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-TALK, or you can send an email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thank you.
It's our Friday Media Roundtable here on Your Call. I'm Angie Coiro, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we are featuring two guests reviewing the week's news, along with you and your phone calls to 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134. And the phone number, for those of you out of the immediate Bay Area, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Our guests are Mark Gungloff, Chief Financial Writer at the Huffington Post, and Kevin Hall, Economic Correspondent for the McClatchy Newspapers. Kevin, I interrupted you mid-anecdote, so why don't you pick up where you left off?
And I'm embarrassed to say I think it just went right out of mind, so why don't we keep moving?
Funny how that happens, isn't it? Well, you know, when we were talking in the midst of talking about Dodd-Frank, and regulators have held 14 times as many meetings with the financial companies as they actually have with reform advocates ever since Dodd-Frank became law. And I wonder if you've observed, and I'll ask this of either of you, have you observed any effort on behalf of those who are endorsing less Wall Street-friendly financial change, if you've seen any efforts with them to make more meetings, if there's some way to balance this equation in any way? Let me start with you on this, Kevin.
Well, there have been tons of meetings, and the rulemaking process is a pretty public process. The problem is that interest groups, advocacy groups, you know, have much smaller resource levels than these big institutions. The thought that it went out of mind, had gone out of mind, actually ties into this, and it has to do with the lawsuits. One of the big setbacks for Dodd-Frank is that the financial services industry has won three major pushbacks, some of it on stock regulation, others on commodities, and what were called position limits, so that big oil traders couldn't take more than a certain percentage of the market. All three of those major cases were all lost by the government, won by industry. The lawyer representing industry is Justice Scalia's son, Eugene Scalia, who has a 3-0 record right now in beating back Dodd-Frank. So I think the financial industry has a lot of legal firepower, and I think that's been one of the big stories here, too.
Mark, your thoughts?
Yeah, what Kevin says is correct. And the one sort of way that the pro-reform advocates can get their message out is through the media, and there are a couple of organizations that are actively working the media to try to sort of use us as a megaphone for their views, and that helps. But yes, they don't have nearly the resources. I mean, we're sort of leverage. They're using us maybe for leverage to sort of get their message out, but I still don't know if that is as influential as the money and the many, many lobbyists that that the banks have that can flood Washington at all times.
I want to remind our listeners that any of the stories that we refer to, especially those by our guests themselves, will be up on our website at yourcallradio.org, so you'll be able to take a peek at those for yourself and see them in more detail. We're talking largely about the economic stories of the week. Of course, any of the stories that have been run during our Friday Media Roundtable are open for your comment. I want to look at a couple more specifics of Dodd-Frank before we move on. There's a new report by the Economic Policy Institute that says that Wall Street and bankers' compensation without producing anything has a direct relationship to the rising inequality in the U.S. Moira Herbst, writing in The Guardian, said, no matter what New York Times columnist Friedman and his followers say, we are not living in a sharing economy. We're living in a zero-sum economy in which a handful of investors and owners win at everyone else's expense. These big financial institutions are making a lot of money, and rather than really producing anything, they're pretty much collecting rent. And let me put as an addendum to that, an in-depth investigation by David Konuski of Shuffle of Aluminum, but to banks pure gold. That's Goldman Sachs and other banks making millions of dollars by moving aluminum around in warehouses for no apparent reason. It's the transit of the aluminum that eventually goes into Coke cans or cars or house siding. It's generating income for them, but costs the economy $5 billion in the past 3 years, according to various estimates. And as two people who are charged with translating the reality of this kind of economic mucking around for the public, some of that is so obscure and so peculiar that you wonder if, as consumers, we can even grasp that reality, let alone, you know, try to join the reform movement to change it.
Yeah. Kevin here. Can I jump in on that?
Yeah, please.
It's something that I've spent the last 3 years kind of writing as often as I can and in as many ways as I can. What that showed, and it's something that we've shown in coffee and cotton and certainly in oil, is what these financial players are trying to do is create the perception of scarcity. So if the market, if stuff is moving around a warehouse and isn't there, then the spot market responds to the perception that supply is tight. It happened a lot in coffee, the famous Sinatra song, they put coffee in the coffee in Brazil. There is no shortage of coffee in the world, but they drew down supplies in warehouses to give this perception of coffee shortages. And a couple of years ago, coffee was $7 a can. It's happened, take your commodity, it's happened virtually in every commodity, and it's a way to make a killing on the back of a consumer, and we seem unwilling, our government, through two administrations, seems unwilling to address this.
We're talking about the economy as it was covered in the media this week, and I do want to ask our listeners what you think about how the economy was covered in media, in print, in broadcast, and of course we can expand beyond this week because it's a topic that goes well back into the past and will continue into the future, unfortunately. And what do you want journalists to write about and focus on? What are the important economic issues that you feel aren't getting much attention, that you'd rather see more coverage of, and where, of course, we always want to give kudos where due, where did you see the best reporting this week? Our phone number is 415-841-4134. That's if you're in the 415 area code, 415-841-4134 or 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Mark Gongloff is with us, Chief Financial Officer at the Huffington Post, and Kevin Hall is with us, Economic Correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Some more interesting reporting out there on the economy this week, and Mark and Kevin, I'll take this to both of you. There was an article that quoted an Oxfam study that said that the top 3% of the rich, not just in the United States, but around the globe, actually now have more money than the 300 billion people below them on the economic scale. It's an astounding number. It brings the question to me about how well economic issues are covered with an eye toward how the American system compares internationally, because when we talk about these huge economic inequalities, it's natural to focus at home. But this is, in fact, an international problem. Mark?
Well, it's an international problem to the extent that these are international markets, and the sort of orthodoxy of economic thought that sort of took root in the past three decades or so is shared somewhat broadly now in the United States. It is worse than in many other countries because we have maybe because we have embraced that orthodoxy more readily than anybody else. And this ties to what Kevin was just talking about, this business of Wall Street finding ways to, create the illusion of scarcity to make money. This rent seeking, as economists call it, what that does is it simply drains capital away from the rest of the economy. I mean, in a normally functioning, properly functioning economy, you would have banks, and banks would make money, and everybody would be happy. There's nothing wrong with banks making money, but it is the fact that they are not contributing anything at all to society. They are not contributing to future growth or productivity. They're just simply milking as much as they can out of the economy, and that actually those are resources that could be going to things like finding ways to promote clean energy or education or infrastructure or all the things that President Obama talked about in his speech today, and it is directly tied to income inequality, and it is a global problem, but it certainly is worse here at home.
Well, Kevin, that goes to a very, very murky area, and that is that some of the money that is spent by these multinational corporations is into image advertising. So you may have the reality that they're not producing anything that benefits society as a whole, regardless of which country we're talking about. But they sure churn out advertising and other image work that makes it look as though they're good corporate citizens and good members of society, and that they're there for the betterment and happiness of all of us.
Well, and they do an awful lot of charitable giving. There's no doubt about that. And it also depends on whether you define this just narrowly as Wall Street banks, or do you more broadly get into private equity. It's interesting. One of the things we've been looking into is a bit of the expanding role of private equity in the energy boom as well that's been taking place, and that raises the question again of who benefits and who doesn't. Traditionally in the country, we used to have you build a company from sweat, your sweat equity, then you take it public and the shareholders share your success and everybody wins. Well, that model seems to be disappearing, and more often than not as much in the tech world. Somebody will argue, well, Facebook or Twitter, and those have become public offerings, but kind of the nuts and bolts, real physical parts of our economy are increasingly in the hands of private equity investors and big deep-pocketed players, and who don't always have the best interest of the public in mind, as we're seeing with what's happening with prices.
Let me ask about, we were talking about the international picture, and one of the differences that journalists are charged with deconstructing is the Europeans are taking a look at their $3 trillion tax havens. Taxes are being they're more aggressive in Europe, and there seems to be a wider acceptance of them in Europe. And here in the U.S., there's anti-tax sentiment, and many of the same voices that fault the failures of the government, are all very pleased to cut off the taxes that keep the government going. So I just wonder about the job that you're charged with doing in trying to put all this in its proper context. Well, basically instructing people in how it works, Mark.
Yeah, well, first about the issues here, and this, this goes to the primary, I think, conflict in our country and our economy, is the conflict between liberty and equality. We want to maximize liberty, and we also want to maximize equality, and those two things are not always compatible. We can't have perfect equality, but if you let the free market run wild, then you would have vast inequality, and that would cause all kinds of problems too. So we have to strike a balance, and this has been what we've been fighting about for many, many years. And our job as people who write about economics is, the big problem, the biggest problem we face is that this stuff is extremely obscure and boring, frankly, and until you look up one day and realize, hey, my 401k is gone. Oh, look, the Dow's down 600 points. What the heck's going on? So the goal for us is to try to make this stuff relatable and understandable, obviously without dumbing it down, but to point out to people why it is that they should care about, J.P. Morgan allegedly rigging electricity markets in California. The job is a little bit easier now after the financial crisis because there is a lot of anger out there. But the job is to sort of take, not foster that anger so much as to try to find a way to put things in better context and explain things and help to broaden people's actual understanding of what's really going on.
Kevin, did you want to get a thought in on that?
Yeah, I think the challenge is also, having most of us also have to write about the daily news cycle, and it pulls, things like the IRS scandal and jobs numbers and things like that kind of dig into that. But we're also, if you're here in Washington and having to cover the Federal Reserve, you're dealing with a lot of things tied to, when it pulls back on the so-called tapering of its program. So part of the challenge is finding the time and the space to do those kind of connect the dots pieces in between all your daily reporting. We are living in some pretty unprecedented times in terms of the economy as well.
I want to switch directions and talk about something that's really been blowing up in the economic media of late, and very much on social media as well, and that is the appointment of a new chairman of the Federal Reserve. It's been interesting to watch, especially as this is the Friday Media Roundtable. It's been interesting to watch the media shuffle around this issue. Ezra Klein first wrote a report that he believed Janet Yellen was the front runner, with Larry Summers running behind. The next day, he said, gosh, I really been made aware that it's Larry Summers who's the front runner. And you started to see some reaction right away around the internet, around some of the major media outlets, about those who are opposed to Larry Summers. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Matt Iglesias, writing in Slate magazine, then said, wow, I see a pattern of an intricate and thorough leak job here. Someone leaked to Ezra Klein that Larry Summers is the front runner, and they simultaneously leaked to all these other media outlets, that this is the time to take your aim and point your arrows at him if you want to get it done. I found that a really interesting take on how an important topic such as this gets out into the media. I didn't necessarily agree with Matt Iglesias' take. I found it interesting that he thought that was necessary for something to catch fire in the media, for there to be a conspiracy and a leaker behind that. But there's so much for us to deconstruct here. And key to that is the character of Larry Summers himself and whether he is, in fact, the front runner, what difference it makes who the chairman of the Federal Reserve is and what his prior experience and his prior credentials have to do with that. So let's try to unpack some of that. And Mark, if I can start with you. The way that you saw the story emerge into the media, did you find anything, you know, particularly conspiracy-like about it?
Well, first I will say that any of these sorts of stories do require at least one leaker, right? So somebody had to talk to Ezra Klein and say, hey, by the way, this is what's going on. I can't read that person's mind and figure out their motives. It's possible that the White House wanted to float this as a trial balloon in the middle of the summer to see what people thought, and the reaction has been visceral and at least and certainly from the left, and I don't know if that actually helps Larry Summers' chances or not, or hurts them, but you know, just today, in fact, after this pretty sharp reaction against Larry Summers, the White House said, and I don't know if this is they did this because of this, but they said they weren't going to make a decision until the fall. They've pushed it off, and so you know, maybe they're going to give people time to think it over, let people cool off a little bit. Maybe they want people to forget that they are going to introduce Larry Summers, although I think a lot of people in the media have lots of anti-Larry Summers articles that they were going to push a button on this week or next week that they're going to hold off until the fall. So I don't think the issue is going away. But clearly, you know, whenever you're talking to a source on the phone, they have an agenda, you know, they have some reason and to tell you that. And you do have to think about that. You do have to be conscious all the time of, you know, why is this person telling me this? And you have to be careful about that context when you report the story. Now, I think it's great that this news came out because I personally don't think Larry Summers would be nearly as good as a Fed chair as Janet Yellen was. And the other interesting aspect of this was another Ezra Klein piece before all this started where he suggested that the sort of anti-Janet Yellen whispering going on in Washington, maybe helped by fans of Larry Summers, had smacked of some sexism because the personal characteristics of Janet Yellen are very similar to the personal characteristics of Ben Bernanke, kind of quiet, academic, consensus building, you know, in a man, male professor from Princeton, I guess that seems okay, and in a female vice chair of the Fed, to some people that maybe seems less okay, and so, you know, there was some question about, are we treating her differently because she's a woman?
Yeah, actually some of the phrasing that he brought up was really interesting. For example, she lacks gravitas.
She's probably has more gravitas than virtually everyone there. The great irony, of course, is that one thing that Bernanke has made his hallmark at the Fed is in communication, in the first old press conferences, to publicly have the forecast and try to explain with infinite mind-numbing detail why the Fed does what it does. And Yellen obviously has been a big part of that. Larry Summers, there are few people who like to hear themselves speak more than Larry Summers. And a Fed news conference with Larry Summers would probably be two questions over the course of 90 minutes. So there are plenty of reasons why he would be just an awful choice, not the least of which the fact that we had a strong Fed chairman who wasn't so much a consensus builder kind of got us into this mess to begin with. When I first saw the story, my first reaction was it was someone in the Summers camp leaking it to try to get his, you know, drum up support, or, you know, as this town often works sometimes, it's the ulterior motive that you want to build support for Yellen, so you put it out there. Because up until recently, no credible person thought Summers had a prayer of being on that short list.
Oh, wheels within wheels. That's it. If you'd like to contribute to our conversation during our Friday Media Roundtable, the numbers to call, 415-841-4134. In San Francisco, outside the 415 area code, you can dial 866-798-8255. I'm Angie Coiro, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and we're talking about stories economic as we do our Friday Media Roundtable, reviewing some of the more important stories of the week with Kevin Hall, economic correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and Mark Gongloff, chief financial writer at The Huffington Post. Well, since, Kevin, you went to the possible motivations behind this story coming out, I want to talk about Barack Obama's speech that he gave at Knox this week and what kind of points he was attempting to make about his efforts in the economy. He did address Republican obstructionism. If there really was sentiment to get Larry Summers in the Fed Reserve chair, you have to wonder what that tells us about the economic direction President Obama is you know, trying to grasp where he's trying to go with the economy and what his influences are. So let's talk a bit about that. Mark, your comments on the speech at Knox?
Well, the speech was widely panned in the media, which I think means it was probably a pretty good speech. It was panned because it was not. People complained that it didn't bring a lot of new ideas to the table. Everybody wanted new ideas, but the problem is that he is addressing the stuff that he said also in 2005 and in the exact same place, and everybody made a big deal out of that. But the truth of the matter is that these are long-term problems, and they have been with us for a while, and there are actually some fairly reasonable solutions to them, and those solutions haven't necessarily changed. As somebody pointed out today, if you want to stay healthy, you eat right and exercise, and that's a very boring answer to that. It's much more boring than a fad diet or something like that. But the president was saying eat your vegetables and exercise, and that bored everybody in the media, but it was true. The problem is that the prescriptions that he has laid out over and over and over again have met with much resistance in the Republican Congress.
Kevin?
Yeah, I would concur. I think one of the challenges has been, if you look at next week, we're going to get our second quarter GDP numbers, which is going to be under 2%, most likely as low as perhaps just 0.5%. And historically, we have not, as an economy, when you have two or three quarters of sub 2% growth, it usually is a harbinger of recession. It's not the case now because we're in this unique place where the private sector part of the economy is growing at 3-3.5%, and the government sector is pulling that down to 1%, 0.5%. So a lot of these things that what's frustrating Obama so much is half of the economy is really performing well, but the whole picture gets dragged down because of this whole fiscal mess. And I think we're going to, we're looking at a situation where we're likely to have a repeat where they won't come to an agreement and it will be some sort of, sequester taking effect, because it's the way to make a tough decision without making a tough decision. So I think, the challenge in a speech like that is everybody knows why we're not growing, at least from the economic side and those of us who write about it. And so he's trying to get attention without hitting the same themes, like they won't let me do what I want to do, which is a tough message to sell.
Well, he did deal with obstructionism, and I think that got some response from those on the left or the Democrats, however much intersection there is between the two, to say at least he's calling them out. At least he's calling, he's speaking the truth that nobody's letting him get any moves through there. And for as many as may have reacted that way, and Kevin, as you kind of know, there's nothing really new about him pointing that out. Did that accomplish anything, Mark, in your eyes, for him to point to obstructionism and say they're not letting this happen?
You asking me, Mark?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I think everybody knows that it's happening, and you either like it or you don't like it. Congress's approval rating was below 20%, I think a record low or something. Everybody realizes that there is a huge obstacle in Congress, and so, yeah, the risk that he runs in going on and on about it is people start to complain about him being him adding to the problem, and it also kind of makes you look weak, I guess. I'm not paid by anybody to be a political strategist, thank goodness, so don't. It could potentially make you look weak if you're just constantly complaining about the opposition all the time. But it's obviously worth noting, certainly if you're going to talk about the economy and you're going to talk about the problems in the economy, one of the big problems in the economy is we're not spending as much as we could on infrastructure. We are actually spending a whole lot of energy on figuring out ways to slow the economy down with things like the sequester raising the payroll tax and stuff like that. We're the government, as Kevin pointed out, is actively working against the economy right now, and you have to mention that.
Kevin, quickly, please.
No, exactly right. I don't think people understand fully, and we certainly try to in what we do, mention it as often as we can and show how that's happening, that, in fact, the consequence to these tighter budgets in a time like this is a pullback, particularly in defense spending, but it's really been across the board. And it's been very much on state and local levels, too. This is part of the adjustment when you come out of, you know, being at near the abyss of financial ruin, which we were very close to in 2008.
Oh, we have such a short window of time left. This has gone so fast. But I do want to give you a moment to tell us what articles on the economy we should be looking forward to seeing from each of you. So starting with Mark Gungloff, what are you working on now that we should keep an eye out for?
Well, I would like to keep writing about this concept about banks sort of draining vitality from the economy with their rent seeking. I mean, I think as this issue of their copper warehousing continues to be in the media, people will be thinking about this, and it's a good time to talk about that. Ironically, recently, just this week, Goldman Sachs analysts wrote a note saying that they favored commodities, which was a little bit ironic. No wonder they favor commodities if they're hoarding them. There's also the question, there's an interesting debate right now about, in light of this indictment of SAC Capital, this hedge fund, about whether or not insider trading should be legal. So, you know, there are a number of econo-wonks who think that you should actually legalize insider trading because it helps make markets more efficient. But I think, you know, and it's sort of a tricky call. It's complicated, but I kind of think that there are some good arguments for keeping it illegal.
Kevin, I'm afraid we got just a little minute here to find out what you're working on.
Well, I would just highly recommend reading everything Mark writes, but separate from that, I think just keep hitting. We're trying to keep hitting on this labor issue because the things that are happening now in our labor markets are so distressed, even with the improving job numbers, whether it's the participation rate and things like that, it's still tremendous stress in the labor markets.
I want to thank you both very much for joining us. And I'm Angie Coro, sitting in for Rose Aguilar on Your Call, thanking Kevin Hall, Mark Gungloff, and Ahmed Shaq for joining us earlier. Thanks for your phone calls as well. This is Your Call. What's behind Detroit going bankrupt? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the socioeconomic transformation of Detroit. The population of the city has declined from about 2 million in 1950 to 700,000 today. It's been described as an economically devastated city surrounded by some of the richest suburbs in the nation. How did this happen? And what will it take for Detroit to recover from bankruptcy? Why are cities going bankrupt? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.